supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm John Weber. This is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. In May, a former Philadelphia City finance director named Rebecca Reinhart delivered a stunning blow to the city's Democratic Party when she beat three-term incumbent city controller Alan Butkovitz in the city's primary. But there's another race to run this fall, and Republican candidate Mike Tomlinson hopes he can manage an upset win of his own and become Philadelphia's first Republican controller in nearly 50 years. WHYY's Dave Davies joins us now to talk about the candidate and the contest. Dave, first, what is the city controller and what does he or she do?
John, it's the city's official auditor and financial watchdog. It was established as an elected position in the city charter because the framers figured the controller needed to have an independent power base, not be beholden to the mayor. So in municipal elections, when we're not electing the mayor, we choose a city controller.
So Mike Tomlinson is the Republican candidate in this overwhelmingly Democratic town. What does he bring to the campaign?
Well, he's a Philly guy through and through. Grew up in the Northeast, delivered the Philadelphia Bulletin as a kid, bussed tables at the Mayfair Diner, went to Temple and got a degree in business administration. He's 60 years old, says he spent a lot of his professional career in auditing and financial compliance in companies and nonprofits, which is relevant to this office. But then he told me this happened to him 7 years ago.
I went legally blind. I was doing a consulting agreement down in Virginia at Freddie Mac, and they didn't renew my contract because I couldn't see the computer.
Yeah, John, Tomlinson learned in his 20s that he had this genetic condition called retinitis pigmentosa, which could impair his vision and eventually did. He said he's still legally blind but has some vision, and with the help of some high-tech equipment, he can read documents and has returned to work. But he's focused on this campaign for now.
Given the way Democrats dominate the city, does he have a chance?
Well, you'd have to see it as a long shot. You know, Democrats have a 7-to-1 voter registration edge in the city. The last Republican city controller we had was Tom Gola, elected way back in 1969. And it's a measure of Gola's impact on city politics that most of his obituary focused on his basketball career. He was a college standout at LaSalle and a 5-time NBA All-Star. But the city Republican Party's experienced something of a resurgence in recent years. There have been some energetic new leaders that say they have to recruit candidates and compete in races whether they win or not, hoping eventually the party will become more competitive.
So what's his case that he's better than the Democrat, Rebecca Reinhart?
You know, I think his strongest case is that in a city where Democrats run City Hall, you ought to have somebody from the other party in the controller's job. And the Republicans have been making that case, but it hasn't been a winning one for a long time. Tomlinson says the school district and the city pension fund aren't getting the scrutiny they should and that he has the background and independence to do it. And like a lot of other Philadelphia Republicans, he's adopted a more moderate profile than the national party leaders have. Here's how Tomlinson put it to me.
I'm not some lunatic, right-wing, conservative Republican. I'm a centrist, and I care about the community. I'm known as an advocate for the homeless and the drug addicted up here in our neighborhood.
So how does he match up against the Democrat Reinhart, who managed that big upset in May?
Well, the one good thing for Tomlinson about facing Reinhart is that she's a relative newcomer to politics with low name recognition, unlike Butkovitz. On the other hand, she isn't the incumbent, and she makes the case that because she ran against and beat the Democratic organization, she has the independence to do the job taxpayers deserve. The big problem Tomlinson has, John, really, which every Republican in this city faces, is that it takes money to get a message out, and it's hard to raise it when you face the kind of odds he does. Reinhart raised close to $500,000 this year. Tomlinson has raised about $15,000. But he says, you know, he knows he's David against Goliath, and sometimes the underdog wins.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
The second week of clearing out a heroin haven along the Conrail tracks in Philadelphia's Kensington neighborhood is drawing to a close. As Joel Wolfram reports for WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, bulldozers have reached the most notorious drug encampment in the railroad gulch, known as El Campamento.
Asteria Vivas walks down tracks left by a bulldozer along the patch of dirt where makeshift huts used to stand.
People were literally watching it like it was a movie. They were like, some of them were like devastated and a few happy and a few lost because they don't know where to go now.
Vivas is an outreach volunteer who has been trying to help drug users at El Campamento for the past year and a half. All that remains of the camp are three shacks hugging a fence at the top of the slope leading down to the tracks, and two giant mounds of trash below. They contain the white wrappers of syringes, mattresses, and wooden pallets that were used to build the makeshift shelters. But the camp isn't completely abandoned yet. As we stand there, three people move through a hole in the fence and disappear inside of one of the remaining shacks known as the doctor's office, where users could pay someone to inject them with heroin.
The people that just went in, I do know them. You do get to know them. You get to know them as a friend, and you get to know them like a family.
But when Conrail dismantles these shelters and puts up new fencing here, drug users will likely look for other places to shoot up. Outreach workers like Vivas are encouraging them to get help instead. They're making progress, but it's slow work. In the first week of the cleanup, the city reports 50 people were referred to treatment from mobile outreach stations set up near the tracks. That's less than half of the 141 people who spoke to outreach workers. For many, getting treatment isn't as easy as it sounds. On the street outside El Campamento, Vivas approaches a man she recognizes named Dante. He's been in treatment before and is trying to get help again.
I don't like to get high. I enjoy the feeling, but I don't like...
You don't
I
don't,
like, I don't like all this.
I don't
feel comfortable with this.
It's pretty much destroying you.
Dante has a job and private health insurance, but is having a hard time finding a place in Philadelphia where he can get the intensive outpatient treatment he says he needs. A program he had been through before said they weren't taking new patients.
But they also was telling me that they don't take my insurance. And I was like, I take my insurance? What do you mean? They take mostly welfare insurance.
Dante says that's also true of the treatment programs where he lives in West Philadelphia. He says he's sent his intake papers to a place in Center City, but he's waiting to hear back. Vivas says she'll look into some other options for Dante. For now, she can only offer him a sandwich and words of encouragement. For WHYY, Joel Wolfram.
This work week started with President Trump touting jobs and economic enthusiasm in a tweet contending that his base is still enthusiastic about his time in office so far. NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller enlisted the help of Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll, to dissect the president's claims.
Frank, it does seem that economic confidence is up.
It is indeed. We're at a +7 now, economic confidence, which is our way of measuring consumer confidence, and that's up for where it's been the last several months. In fact, it's up in general since Trump took office. It was much worse than that in the last months of 2016 than it has picked up. We look internally, we see that's largely because Republicans have become much more positive about the economy, not Democrats. But when you put it all together, Americans are more confident in the economy than they have been at any point in a number of years.
And with the unemployment rate hovering at, I believe, 4.4%, many are citing that as technically full employment. Do Americans think it's a good time to find a job?
They do, and we even use the word quality when we ask the question that you just mentioned, Dave. Is now a good time to find a quality job? And 59% of Americans say it is. That is the highest by 1 point. It was 58% a month or two ago, but 59% is the highest percentage of Americans who said it's a good time to find a quality job since we've been measuring this on a monthly basis, and that goes back to 2001. In 2009, after the recession, 2011, that percentage was 8 percentage points. Less than 10% of Americans said it was a good time to find a quality job. So clearly, Americans have flipped around now and are much, much more optimistic about the job market.
So what of the president's contention that his base is driving even closer together? Now, by his base, does he mean all Republicans or a subset thereof?
Well, that's a good question, and you would have to ask President Trump exactly what he means when he says that my base is solid. 82% of those who identify as Republicans approve of the job he's doing. But actually, it's not as high as it has been. He's had in the upper 80% of Republicans who've approved of the job he's doing since he took office in January. In fact, that 82% is as low as we've seen it on a weekly basis. So he may say his base is doing better than ever, but it's actually down slightly from where it's been. But you put it all together. Remember, Democrats have single-digit approval of the job he's doing. You put it all together, and his approval rating, as we've talked about many times, Dave, is hovering right in there in that 36, 38%, 39% rating range.
Let's look at support for a specific Republican, that being Arizona Senator John McCain.
Yeah, this is remarkable. His overall favorable rating among all Americans is 58%, and that's 33% who disapprove of Senator McCain. Last time we measured Senator McCain, it was at 53%, so his overall approval has actually edged up now over the last couple of years. But what's truly remarkable, Davis, when we look at Republicans and Democrats, Republicans' favorable rating of John McCain have actually diminished, gone from 61 to 51%. But Democrats, and remember, McCain is a Republican senator, of course. Democrats' favorable rating of McCain have gone from 49% when we last measured it all the way up to 71%. That's remarkable for Democrats to be much more positive about a Republican figure than his own Republican Party. And, of course, we assume that has to do with his vote not to allow the debate to go on the Senate health care bill, for which he was lauded by Democrats such as New York Senator Chuck Schumer. But as we've seen in the data here, Republicans are not so happy about that.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
It looks like we'll be able to indulge in New Jersey oysters with no guilt this summer. Efforts to bring them back are paying off. This year's oyster population is the highest in 5 years, and oystermen are being allowed to harvest more oysters this year than in the past 2 decades. But as State Impact Pennsylvania's Catalina Jaramillo reports, there's uncertainty around the impact of climate change.
The Delaware Bay was once known as the oyster capital of the world. That was last century. New Jersey communities like Bivalve and Shell Pile produced tons of oysters. About 600 sailboats fished wild oysters from natural beds in the bay. And oysters were shipped by train all over the country.
The railroad built this building.
Rachel Dolhansek, curator of the Bayshore Center in Bivalve, shows us what's left from those oyster-rich times.
So you'd have to imagine about 40 boxcars here lined up. They would do 2 shipments a day, one in the morning and one later in the day.
That's a lot of oysters. And it's hard to imagine today that Bivalve was that busy. Now, the town is small and quiet, a beautiful port with no more than 12 oyster boats located on the mouth of the Morris River in South Jersey. Sherry Gattier works at the museum's restaurant.
At one time, there were car dealers and movie theaters and department stores and tons of speakeasies. And it was a very big thing. You know, when the oyster industry was booming, unfortunately, when they died, it died.
A disease known as MSX killed about 90% of the oysters in the 1950s. In a couple of years, the oysters became resistant to MSX and started growing back. But in the 1990s, a new parasite called Dermo attacked them again. Steve Fleetwood is one of the few remaining oyster fishermen. He's been in the business for 40 years.
Hello, lady.
We're in a room filled with fresh oysters.
Smell good, huh?
I'm in paradise. Okay. Well, from here, they go to fancy raw bars in Philadelphia and the rest of the country. But the Jersey oyster almost went extinct. Fleetwood says oystermen realized they had to stop overfishing, and they teamed up with the Department of Environmental Protection and Rutgers University to manage the resource through fishing quotas. For years, it was hard to make a good living.
It's tough when you're doing something that you really like, but you can't tell your kids that, you know, to come here and work with you.
But as scientists and fishermen began working together, oysters started coming back. This year's quota is the largest in more than 20 years, and because oysters are trendier now, the business is even better.
It's a yuppie thing, you know, go to the raw bar and eat 3 or 4 different kinds of oysters. But that's kind of turned the industry around, I think, and people were looking for that, you know, nice-looking, nice-meat oyster. And we got it.
Fleetwood thinks now the oyster business is something his grandchildren could pursue.
I have one, and I hope I could tell him that, yeah.
Last year, there were 1.8 billion oysters in the natural beds of the Jersey portion of the bay. That's a record. And today, there's more baby oysters, or spats, than in 10 years. So, if mortality caused by the oyster parasite Dermo keeps going down, the industry might see glory days again. But scientist Daphne Monroe says climate change could bring a new set of uncertainties for the oyster business. She studies oysters at the Rutgers University Shellfish Lab.
There's some oyster experiments going on here, I think, testing salinity tolerances and things like that.
Monroe says the parasite Dermo does better in high salinity. Oyster beds located higher in the bay have less mortality, but sea level rise could push salt water up the bay, increasing mortality.
An interesting interaction there is if storm frequency and precipitation increases, that helps to push the salt wedge back down bay. And so you get these kind of conflicting forces.
Another uncertainty is what will happen with more heat. Higher temperatures may be good for oysters because it makes them grow faster, but warmer water could also bring more predators like jellyfish or crabs. But people in bivalve are optimistic. The fishery is generating about $18 million for the region's economy, and oyster farming is also growing. Brian Harman grows oysters in farms instead of fishing them in the wild. He gets the baby oysters from the shellfish lab and then grows them in the bay.
Each year, the industry's growing in our state, and oyster farming has, locally in Delaware Bay anyway, has tremendous potential for growth.
Harman recently opened a farm in Bivalve, next to the museum. And Sherry Gautier from the restaurant says there's rumors of another big company coming in.
The fact that the oysters are coming back is going to revitalize this area and really help a nice little hometown to thrive again.
Her business has clients constantly. It's Friday, about 2 p.m., and three women from South Jersey were enjoying some fried oysters.
How are they?
Excellent.
Very good.
They say Delaware Bay oysters are the best, but they make an important distinction.
Not just the Delaware Bay, the Jersey oysters, because the Delaware Bay, you know, encompasses other states. We're partial to Jersey oysters.
Catalina Jaramillo, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
A traveling exhibition of the work of Louis Kahn has returned to the place where the famous architect made his name. Philadelphia's Fabric Workshop and Museum is the final venue for the show that has already been around the world. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports the exhibition shows the breadth of the architect's thinking.
Back in the 1960s, Kahn explained that his architectural ideas were about light and silence. Bill Whitaker, is a curator at the University of Pennsylvania's Architectural Archive, said when Kahn spoke about silence, he wasn't talking about noise, but referring to something fundamentally human.
Kahn's buildings sometimes are difficult for people to like at first. They can be very raw. In some ways, some people might think they're ugly. But there is an inner beauty that reflects the sense of connection that comes from silence.
Kahn taught at the University of Pennsylvania for two decades, from the 1950s to his death in 1974. He's often associated with the style brutalism, which involves a lot of raw concrete. The exhibition at the Fabric Workshop and Museum shows how Kahn took inspiration from ancient structures around the world. There are photographs and sketches he made during visits to the Egyptian pyramids and the Parthenon in Greece. Whitaker points out that Kahn was less interested in their massive scale, more so in the way light played off their surfaces.
Even though he might use a lot of concrete, that concrete doesn't come off as a heavy material, right? Because in the surface of the concrete, it creates shadows. He creates shadow joints and light joints. There's a liveliness to the surface through the engagement with natural light. It defies gravity in some ways.
The exhibition includes drawings and interior recreations of homes designed by Louis Kahn. He only designed 9 private homes, all of them in the Philadelphia region. And as part of this exhibition, Whitaker will be giving tours of 2 of those houses. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov. Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. We had help this week from our intern, Kate Summers, to whom we bid a fond farewell. The news director is Eugene Son. Our assistant news director is Katie Culinary. John Musoni is assistant vice president of news operations. Our engineers this week were Al Banks and Charlie Kyer. Sandra Clark is president of News and Civic Dialogue.